Hello, I'm Matthew Leyland. Welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film. And thanks for taking out a subscription to the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today, I'm joined by our contributing editor, James Mottram. And this week, we're rating Todd Field's and Cate Blanchett's look at the orchestral world, Tar, creepy doll horror, Megan, British folk horror, Ennis Main, and Nicolas Cage Western, The Old Way. But before we get to those, what have you been watching this week, James?
Well, I finally got around to watching The Rest of the Bear, which I think has just won some prizes for its lead actor, Jeremy Allen White, won a Golden Globe last night. I watched it with my partner, and she told a friend that she was watching it, who'd already seen it, and they were like, episode 7, which is the shortest episode of the 8, it's the most stressful thing I've ever seen.
Really?
And I watched it, and it's a really good show, and it is a stressful episode. Yeah. And then I said to her, but you've not seen Uncut Gems, have you? It's like that, but 2 hours long with Uncut Gems, or longer, I think.
Yeah.
It's a bite-sized amount of stress. Obviously it's all set in this Chicago kind of sandwich shop, basically. Very nice-looking sandwiches, I have to say. It's quite stressful. It's not one of those calm kitchens. If you go to posh restaurants and you see them in those kind of, where they're in their zen-like state, like in The Menu, if you've seen The Menu.
Serene.
Yeah, there's nothing serene about the bear.
No, I haven't seen it, but how does it compare to Boiling Point? Because I found that incredibly stressful.
It's not dissimilar in the, it captures that working kitchen and things that go wrong really well, but it's more a character-driven, I mean, obviously Boiling Point's a character-driven drama as well, but I guess you do get to see their relationships to some degree outside of the kitchen as well, which of course Boiling Point is very much rooted in that restaurant for an hour and a half. But it's a good time for stressful kitchen dramas.
It really is, isn't it? It's become a genre unto itself. And there's a Boiling Point TV show coming up, I understand. They're making a spin-off from the film that's going to focus more on the supporting characters. So,
who actually are excellent in that show. So or in that film rather. So I would be looking forward to that. I knew nothing of that, so I will look out for that.
Yeah, I can't wait.
What have you been watching this week?
I've been ploughing through, mopping up the some of the films on the London Critics Circle nominations list, which James and I are voting in. I've been watching lots of quality foreign language cinema, like Decision to Leave, Triangle Sadness, RRR, and one I really loved was The Quiet Girl, the Irish drama. That really knocked me for six. I thought that was fantastic. Have you seen that one?
I have seen it. No, it's extremely good. And funnily enough, in a way, I sort of forgot about it over the year. And I don't mean that in a negative way.
No.
I loved it at the time. And then, you know, obviously in the nature of this job, you move on to other things, you see other things. And then people started mentioning it again in terms of awards and nominations. And I was like, of course, that film deserves lots and lots of love because it really is a beautiful piece of work. And I don't really know how it did box office wise, probably not a great deal, I would have thought, but it is worth seeking out.
I think it perhaps flew under the radar a little bit, but hopefully the nominations will kind of give it a bit more prominence and more people might pick it up. But I thought it was absolutely fantastic.
How is RRR, which I really want to try and see, well, before voting, which I think we've got a few days left, but I really want to try and see it on the big screen if I can.
Right,
But I may just have to suck it up and watch it at home.
Yeah.
People tell me it's amazing, but I haven't had a chance to catch it yet.
Yeah, I thought it was fabulous. I watched it on Netflix and it's 3 hours long, so I couldn't watch it all in one go. I had to watch it in stages, but it's... Everything you've heard is true. It's absolutely outrageous and full of these incredibly flamboyant set pieces. It's got this great barreling momentum, fantastic action, great stunts, musical set pieces. Yeah, it's incredibly full on. And it did live up to the hype, I have to say.
And so few films do these days.
Well, exactly.
When you've heard about something a lot
and
then it actually pays off for you, sort of emotionally, and you know, the idea you have of it in your head, that doesn't happen that often, really. Perhaps because we inflate things in our mind.
That's true.
A bit too much. Well, it's good that it's on Netflix as well, so that makes it kind of easy to seek out.
Yeah, nice and accessible. Well, let's move on then. It's time for some disorderly conduct with this.
You want to dance the mask, you must service the composer.
If you're here, then you already know who she is. Lydia Tarr is many things. As a conductor, Tarr began her career with the Cleveland Orchestra, Chicago Symphony Orchestra, the Boston Symphony Orchestra, until she at last arrived here at our own New York Philharmonic. In 2013, Berlin elected Tarr as its principal conductor, and she's remained there ever since. Lydia Tarr has also written music for the stage and screen. She is one of only 15 EGOTs, meaning those who have won all four major entertainment awards. Thank you for joining us, Maestro.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's Tarr. What is Tarr all about, James?
Well, Tarr is a character study based around a fictional character, but she's so well-crafted, you feel like she must have come from real life. Her full name is Lydia Tarr, played by Cate Blanchett. She is what you'd probably call an overachiever. she's one of those people you look at and go, oh my God, she's done so much in her life. She is the chief conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. She's right at the top of her game when we meet her at the beginning of the film. She's married to a wife called Sharon, played by Nina Hoss. She has this sort of high-flying, admiring assistant, played by French actress Noémie Merlant. She's one of those people everyone seems to admire, and yet there is sort of trouble in paradise, basically. There is gradually, as the film unfolds, she begins to unravel. I don't want to say too much about how she unravels.
No.
There's issues with a new young Russian cellist played by Sophie Kauer, who is actually, I think, British-German actress. She's quite, you know, she comes from the sort of musical world. So there's issues with that character, but I won't say too much about what happens to that. There's another sort of off-screen character where there's clearly been issues before, and it's really to do with Lydia's, I suppose, her power play, her what she's done with her power over time. And I mean, people have really called it a sort of film in a post sort of Me Too era, and perhaps that's enough to hint at where we might be going with this.
Yeah,
but I don't think that even really begins to sum up the strangeness of Tarr. There's lots of sort of nightmarish kind of sequences. There's a finale I'd love to talk about, but we can't because it'll give too much away. But it's so bizarre how the film ends up. I loved it as a final payoff, let's say, where the film goes sort of geographically and metaphorically, let's say. Yeah, it's really, like I said at the beginning, it is this sort of character study of this incredibly powerful woman who has effectively abused her power in various ways.
Yeah. And you saw it in Venice, didn't you? The Venice Film Festival, where it premiered there last year. What was the reaction to that first screening?
Yeah, I actually saw it with Jane, funnily enough. We watched it because we were both doing interviews for the film, so we had to see it a little bit before the first press screening.
Okay.
So I didn't see the actual press screening or any public screenings. The problem with any festival, particularly when it's right at the beginning, there's such a sort of glut of things being thrown at you very early on that you watch it. And I thought at the time, you know, it's a long film, it's complex, it's definitely a film that makes you think, but within about 5 seconds, you're moving on to something else that you've got to focus on. That is the nature of film festivals generally, unfortunately. Yeah. And at the time, I remember thinking, it's a really interesting film, but then, you know, a minute later, the Iñárritu film Bardo was playing. Do you know what I mean? It was that sort of situation. And that's a very visual and evocative film as well. So then you're thinking about that. And then Banshees of Inisherin turned up and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm sure the reaction was positive.
Yeah.
I think people liked it. But I think it's a film that, you know, as more and more people have seen it since the festival, you know, it's been in other festivals as well. As more and more people have seen it, I think love has grown for it. Lots of critics or bodies in America have given it best film. It's written and directed by Todd Field, who some people might remember him as the piano player in Eyes Wide Shut years ago.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he went on to make films like In the Bedroom. He hasn't made many films, but this feels like a script he's lived with for so long. And I mean, in the sense of, it's so detailed in terms of that. Even if you had no interest in Lydia Tarr as a character, the way it immerses you in the world of classical music and the kind of political backbiting that goes on behind the scenes was so interesting and so sort of immersive. I felt like I understood. I know nothing about classical music particularly or this world of conductors, but I felt like I did coming out of it. Like you suddenly realize the sort of, you know, it's not just these people standing up waving a baton, you know, in front of an audience. You got to understand the life behind that. And that's what he did really well, I thought, in this film, was just whether he has connections to the classical musical world, I'm not sure. I haven't read anything that says he has, but he clearly understands it or knows people that understand that world. Yeah. And I feel like, it's a film that will grow and grow and grow in appreciation. I'm not sure if it's one of those, when you look at, I was reading someone's article about the Golden Globes yesterday where they say, what film should win, or what film will win, and what film should win. And the will win, which I think turned out to be the case, was The Fabelmans, the Spielberg film. And the should win was Tar, because it is kind of an art house critics kind of movie. It's the sort of movie they love. But you want other people beyond the film bubble to discover this, because it's an astonishing performance by Cate Blanchett. I mean, you know, we're well used to her delivering astonishing performances, but I feel like she hasn't had a role this meaty for, I don't know, maybe even since the Elizabeth movies. I mean, where she's kind of virtually in every frame.
Yeah.
You know, she's done, I mean, obviously she won an Oscar for playing Katharine Hepburn in The Aviator.
Yeah.
And then Blue Jasmine maybe was the last time which she won her other Oscar for.
Yeah.
Maybe was the last time she had a very, very meaty kind of character to lead a film with. But this is just, as I say, just astonishing as a performance. Yeah. I mean, what were you taken with it?
I was, absolutely. I mean, funnily, we're talking about stressful viewing. I did find it incredibly stressful on a first viewing, especially as I saw it in a screening room with incredibly intense sound. Yeah, it kind of took me unawares in several moments. And there were, when you talk about the nightmarish sequences, which I wasn't really expecting, because I was thinking it was going to be this very kind of realist rooted portrait, which it is, but also it does have this kind of horror element that kind of creeps into it, which I won't say too much about. But yeah, I found it incredibly unnerving every time she went to bed and tried to sleep. There's kind of things that start to happen there, and there's other sequences where she's kind of walking through tunnels or going into these kind of empty derelict spaces. And I found all that really unnerving. So I was kind of on the edge the whole way through it. But I mean, I was at the same time, I was absolutely gripped by it. I mean, I thought it was beautifully shot. I mean, it just looks incredible. It looks really kind of rich and expensive and lavish and tasteful.
Yeah, it's really nice to see a film that's obviously, as I said, she's chief conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that means she lives in Berlin. It was great to see Berlin on screen, which is a city I absolutely adore, and doesn't feature in that many movies. And I think it was in one of the Bourne films, for example, where Jason Bourne popped up and was running around. But you know, I think there is a little segment in America, isn't there, if I remember rightly, at one point or another. I think she goes to New York. But you know, largely it's a European set movie, even though it's a, I suppose, American made, American funded. But it just has a real global feel, this film, in a way, you know, in a very, as you would expect from a woman who's that kind of high flying, who's probably in demand all over the world for her talents.
Yeah. And so, well, I mean, Blanchett, she's just won the Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Drama. What do you think of her Oscar chances now?
I can't see who else is going to take it from her. I mean, people say Michelle Williams for The Fabelmans is a possibility, but who knows, because of, you know, I'm not an Oscar voter, that's the thing. But I mean, can you see anyone past this winning it?
Maybe Michelle Yeoh for Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Well, that's probably the other big that's true. I suppose the one thing you could say in Yeoh's favor is she hasn't won before, whereas Blanchett has. And I think there's a lot of love for Michelle Yeoh, generally speaking, film. And of course you know, the film did really well. That's true. I think that's the one possibility. It'd be interesting to see who gets on the campaign trail. If Michelle Yeoh was like, well, you know what, this is my chance. I'll get out there and sell myself, sell the film. Tar hasn't done very well at the box office in America.
No.
It's not really that kind of movie. Whereas Everything Everywhere All at Once did do very well.
Yeah.
You know, perhaps shockingly, really, in some senses, I'm very pleasing that it did do well, but no one really expected that. And maybe that will, it's a bit like the Top Gun Maverick conundrum. Will that win Best Picture based on the fact it effectively saved cinema. And it might not, but we'll have to see. But whether Oscar voters will take that kind of thing seriously remains to be seen. But yeah, Michelle Yeoh would be a very deserving candidate. So yeah, we'll have to remains to be seen.
Yeah, it's quite nice to have it kind of still a bit open at this stage. I do like it. It's a bit disappointing when you get to the Oscars and it does seem like everything's nailed down and all the favourites are going to win. So it's nice to sort of keep that element of competition open for a bit.
Yeah,
longer.
There isn't really a sort of, I say, a front runner in terms of sweeping, you know, a Titanic type, you know, film that will sweep all the categories here. I mean, lots of different films seem to be nailed on for different, you know, for different categories. Yeah. So we shall see.
Okay, so that's Tar, and that's in cinemas from Friday. So now it's time to say hello to our new little friend.
I thought you were going to do it in a Scarface voice, then say hello to my little friend.
Hello to my little friend.
That's pretty good.
Oh, thank you.
I have this project at work. Do you want to see?
Yes.
Ever since I was little, I dreamed of this perfect toy that would protect a kid from ever feeling lonely or sad. This is Megan.
Hi, Megan. I'm Katie. It's nice to meet you, Katie. Do you want to hang out? Okay.
Megan, your goal is to protect Katie from harm, both physical and emotional.
Is that a doll?
Model 3 generative android. Megan, for short.
I can't believe you made this. I love it.
So that was Megan. What is this about? Who is Megan, first of all? And why does she have a 3 in her name?
That stands for Model 3 Generative Android. Uh-huh. And she is a state-of-the-art doll that's been created by Gemma, played by Alison Williams, who you'll probably remember from the TV show Girls and also Get Out. She's so lifelike. She has the ability to pair with a primary user, you know, whoever sort of the doll has been bought for. Mm-hmm. And then she has the ability to sort of learn about the user, learn about her surroundings. I mean, she's the perfect AI creation, only retailing a mere $10,000 as well,
is
as
that
I
all?
Remember.
That's yeah. Saving.
So the you should do. but the Gemma has actually had a sort of tragedy in her life. Her sister and her brother-in-law, which you see in the very beginning of the film, were killed in an accident. And their daughter, Cody, played by Violet McGraw, survived. And Gemma now has to sort of adopt this, her niece. But which is quite handy because it sort of gives her a perfect test subject to run, to try out Megan. It is handy, really. and of course, she has to convince the owners of her company to bankroll this sort of project that she's kind of been effectively secretly working on in the office. And yeah, her niece is sort of perfectly positioned to kind of be the test. As you probably guess, it doesn't go smoothly, as is often the case with crazy dolls. I know it's Chucky all over again, basically, but a slightly more sophisticated Chucky. First of all, there's a neighbor next door who's got a dog who's always coming into their garden. That dog doesn't go too well for the dog, as you could probably guess. After that, I won't go into any more detail, but it all goes downhill from there.
Yeah, I mean, this has been quite hyped up, and it overperformed in its opening weekend at the box office. It's kind of come along and challenged Avatar: The Way of Water at the US box office. It did really, really well, and it's going to make a huge profit because it's quite a low budget horror. Do you think it lived up to the hype?
Yeah, I have to say, I knew very little about this film before I went to see it. But someone said to me, "Oh, what are you seeing today?" And I went, "Megan." And they were like, "What's that?" And I went, "Robot killer doll." That's as much as I knew about it. And I'm not even sure if that's not really very accurate either, I might add. It passed me by in terms of, you know, the up and coming hype, let's say. And yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it, I have to say. I found it quite a lot of fun. It's not particularly scary. I didn't find it particularly scary. No. There are a couple of bits, but I really enjoyed, you know, it was an entertaining genre movie for a start.
Yeah.
But then it is one of these things that makes you think about artificial intelligence. And I had a lot of fun with it. and, you know, certain characters get their comeuppance. I think we could say that. Yeah. I thought the script was quite witty. Mm-hmm. I like Alison Williams generally as a performer. I thought she worked really well as this sort of, you know, boffin slash aunt, basically, yeah. who isn't particularly, you know, au fait with children and no. clearly is, you know, she wants to help her niece, obviously. And yeah, I had a lot of fun with it. What about you?
For the most part, I loved it. And I was really looking forward to it. So I remember at the big screening for Halloween Ends, they showed the trailer and it got such a huge reaction. I mean, it got a better reaction than Halloween Ends did, the film itself. It was like,
well, that's not a surprise, but there you go.
Well, no, yeah, perhaps setting a low bar. But yeah, I've been really looking forward to this. I had a great time with it for the most part. I felt like it perhaps peaked maybe like 2/3 in and then kind of hit a bit of a kind of predictable run towards the end. There are quite a few things I could see coming. There's a few sort of things that are signposted early on that played out in the way I was expecting. And like you say, it's not particularly scary. It's kind of on the sort of creepy spectrum, but perhaps a bit too kind of camp and knowing to be really scary. But I did find it incredibly funny. I mean, I was just laughing and giggling all the way through it. I thought it was the use of music is particularly telling and clever. There's a few songs that Megan herself sings, and then the soundtrack itself is very strong as well. And I thought she was a terrific character. There's been so many creepy dolls over the years. I mean, well, you mentioned Chucky, and we've had Annabelle, and then there's Goosebumps. I mean, it's kind of a trope that pops up all the time. But I thought like this kind of did bring something fresh to the genre, especially in its emphasis on technology and how children use technology. There's quite a lot about whether children rely too much on technology, whether parents rely on technology as kind of electronic babysitters. So it kind of broaches those areas. But at the same time, it just kind of gets on with being a horror comedy. And I thought it really succeeded on that front.
Yeah, I suppose what you could say is Megan isn't supposed to look creepy. No, I mean, you know, she's designed as a doll. Obviously, she's designed to look nice.
Yeah,
but there are certain moments when her facial expressions change and a sort of, let's say, cold demeanor washes over her. And then it's kind of like, whoa, you know. And that's quite interesting because that is obviously, you know, her expressions aren't just set in the way that a plastic doll's expressions are set. Mm. You know, they can change as she reacts emotionally in terms of her programming, let's say. And that is quite interesting. I quite like, there's also very early on, we should say that the Alison Williams character's company have also designed another artificial sort of creature. What are they called? Like perfect pets or something.
Perfect pets.
Yes. And they're these kind of awful things that you can feed virtually via an app, and then they actually excrete, which is a delightful toy. Yes, yeah. they eject little poos, and you just think someone is going to, they probably have already invented something like that, but and it's kind of like those old dolls that used to, you know, wet themselves, but someone will be inventing that very soon. That's what I did like about it. It feels like that we're not that far away from that type of technology, or we're already there perhaps on some level.
Yeah, because it kind of feels, on the one hand, it feels a bit sort of futuristic. There's kind of echoes of things like the Terminator, but on the other hand, it does feel a bit more rooted in the kind of, like you say, with the sort of consumer society we're living in at the moment, and the way technology is leaping forward so fast in terms of everything, in particular consumer electronics and kids' toys and apps and all things like that. Yeah, I like the kind of authentic details to it, like the fact that the company's called Funky with an I. That kind of, that felt to me quite quite true, and it's obviously based on a couple of other companies they've merged together, well, avoiding any sort of copyright issues.
Yes, and Megan is actually, I wasn't sure about this, because again, that's testament, I suppose, to how they made the film, but I think it is actually played by a young girl, and then they've obviously done something with features, you know, sort of digitally speaking. And then I think it's Jenna Davis that's providing the actual voice of Megan. But but it works really well from a sort of physical point of view. The doll moves, you know, in a lifelike way, but not 100% lifelike, because obviously it's not human. And I just thought they nailed the technical side of the film very, very well. It was... Mm-hmm. I fully believe that this doll was an AI creature, and, you know, this is not Haley Joel Osment in the Spielberg AI or something. Yeah. It's advanced a little bit since then.
Yeah, we have to talk about the dancing as well. I mean, the dance there became an instant meme when it appeared in the trailer. So we get some quite funky dance moves at one point in the film. Did you think that
from Megan? Yes, I'm not sure if I've seen. This is how little I've clearly. This is how much this film has passed me by. So I missed the trailer. Miss the memes. I know the dance sequence you're referring to, but
yeah.
So you'll be demonstrating that presumably in the video version of the Tucker Film Podcast, should there ever be one.
I think so. Yeah. I think. Well, next time I'm anywhere near a dance floor, I'm just going to get my Megan on.
And is that like a craze on TikTok then, or something?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I know, being old and out of touch, I know very little about TikTok. But yes, I understand that there are some. It is trending at the moment. And at the multimedia screening before the film started, they had a line of dancers dressed as Megan who came up and did a little performance for us before the film started.
That's not creepy at all. That's probably creepier than the Megan in the film.
So, yeah, I can imagine at this year's Comic-Con, there'll be a lot of cosplaying as Megan.
Are they going to actually release a Megan doll, though, if you know what I mean, on the shelves?
That's the question, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah,
I'm not sure if I'd want one in case it came alive and started, you know, attacking my cat or something.
Yeah, I think I'd need a few guarantees from the manufacturer first that it wasn't, in fact, going to take over my life and threaten my friends and relatives. But yeah, otherwise, I can see this one sort of running on as a franchise. I mean, it doesn't exactly tease a sequel, but there are hints of where it could go.
There is a hint at the end. Undoubtedly, they will if it's been successful. Yeah. Part of me just goes, oh, please don't. It was really good fun. Let's not.
Yeah, the one-off,
but, you know,
yeah.
But that just never happens in Hollywood,
well,
does it?
Well, no, not these. Yeah, if it's a success, then more will follow.
I mean, how many Chucky films have there been?
Endless. Quite... Yeah, reboots, remakes, spin-offs. I'm sure we can look forward to more Megans.
I mean, this is a Jason Blum produced film as well, isn't it? I mean, it's not really anything new to say, but my God, he has the Midas touch when it comes to...
It really does.
You know, relatively low budget. I mean, this may have been a bit more expensive because of the Megan-related effects, but... and yet people just go and see them. I mean, he's always very story driven, first of all, and that seems to be what gets people into the cinemas, as it should.
Yeah, and the profit margins on these films must be quite incredible, like you say, because they're not particularly expensive. They don't always have like huge stars. I mean, they have recognizable names, but not huge stars. They don't go in for these great grandstanding effects. So yeah, he's got a good business plan going on there for sure.
Yeah, so someone should tell James Cameron. I mean, they've made Avatar 2 has made 1.7 billion in, but technically speaking, it's still not in profit. I'm sure it is really, but how they like to sell it to us anyway.
Okay, so that's Megan. You can meet her in cinemas on Friday. Right, are we ready now for some island hopping? How about this? So that's Ennis Main. James, what can you tell me about Ennis Main? There's quite a lot of mystery surrounding this. Yeah. What is it?
I'm first of all very impressed by your pronunciation because I've continually called it Ennis Men just because my brain is too lazy to go. What was it? Main. It's a Cornish island, isn't it? I think.
Apparently it means Stone Island in Cornish.
Stone Island, that's it. This is written and directed by Mark Jenkin, who had a kind of, I suppose, certainly critical hit, I think back in 2019 with Bait, which was a sort of black and white tale of a fisherman, again in Cornwall, which is an area he sort of lives and works in that he knows very well. The critics went crazy over that film. It was sort of made in a very lo-fi 16mm film way. And he's very much continued that working method here for Ennis Main. It's a sort of very lo-fi project, but a beautiful piece of work. It's a kind of folk horror, which is interesting that it's come straight after Alex Garland's Men. That is pronounced Men, not Maine. And
I'm going to call it Maine. Ben Wheatley.
Alex Garland's Maine. And Ben Wheatley's In the Earth. There's a couple of films that came out sort of last year before. Yeah. Again, he's tapping into those sort of folk horror traditions that, you know, England, Great Britain is very famous for. It's all set on this very isolated island, and Mary Woodvine, who is Jenkins' sort of real life partner and was in Bait as well, she plays a character so just known as the Volunteer, really, in the credits. And she's there every day. It really reminded me of Jack Nicholson in The Shining, where he's kind of writing over and over again, all work and no play makes Jack a very dull boy. She's logging in these details every day of the effects of this flower. And she's sort of dropping something into this kind of, it's like a well or something. This sort of big hole in the ground. She's sort of measuring depth there. She's just recording these little scientific details. We don't really know why. There's not a great deal of dialogue in the film.
No.
A lot of the time you get left with her and her thoughts, perhaps listening to the shipping forecast, something like that. I suppose not unlike Tar, she begins to slightly unravel, not in the same kind of way, but just gradually strange goings on happen. There are kind of flashbacks, perhaps, you're not even really sure, but to a sort of fisherman character that has somehow perhaps been in her life. It's a really hard film to put into words because it's a very sensual film in the sense of it's very visual. It relies on sound as well. But as I said earlier, dialogue isn't so crucial. It's not exactly a horror, a bit like Megan, but no creepy dolls in this. It's definitely unsettling as a film. And again, if you're interested in those films that I mentioned earlier, Men and In the Earth, if you like those kind of, even back to something like The Wicker Man, if you like those kind of unsettling films that tap into old sort of, British fables and history, The Green Man and things like that, then this is definitely something you should look at.
Yeah. I mean, do you think it's got much kind of commercial chance, really? Do you think it'll kind of build on Bait?
That's a good question. I mean, probably outside Britain, I'd have to say no.
No.
But, it was in Director's Fortnight, I think, in Cannes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it had some sort of European exposure there. I think people recognise that Bait was a very unique piece of work. And similarly, he's done exactly the same here. Undoubtedly, he was probably offered bigger projects that he could come onto, but they're not going to allow him to work in the way that he worked on Bait and this film in his very own sort of lo-fi kind of way. So I'm really glad he stuck to his guns and made it the way he wanted to make it. There's no question this is his film. And I really appreciate and admire that. And I hope that he does a third film in the same methodology as well. Where he might want to go and make something to have a bigger reach. I think this has got definite cult appeal. Maybe in the cinemas, perhaps not. But it's going to be seen on streaming. I mean, the BFI are backing it, so I'm guessing it will be on their BFI player at some point. It is getting a cinema release as well. Definitely, if you're interested, go and see it on the big screen because. And again, you mentioned with Tar earlier and seeing that film with a really good sound system. I would say the same for this as well. Find a cinema that you know and trust that has a really good sound system. And funny enough, I would actually recommend, as it will obviously be showing at the BFI South Bank, if you live in London, NFT1, the main screen, has a fantastic sound system.
That's the same,
I would recommend seeing any film if you really want to appreciate the sound. But yeah, definitely go and see it there if you live in London or nearby and appreciate the sound. I know, I'd love to see it do well. I just don't know anymore what people go and see. I mean, my partner was telling me about friends who are going to see Avatar at the cinema. And these aren't people that I associate generally with going to the cinema.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm really pleased that they're going to see Avatar.
Yeah.
I would like them to go and see Ennis Maine as well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they will, but clearly Avatar has penetrated their consciousness enough. I suppose because that's the 3D, you've got to see it in the cinema if you're going to appreciate the full water. Immersion. But I'd say that about so many other films. For different reasons. Like you said, for Tar, for the go and see it. Even if you've got a great home cinema set up, you won't get the same experience
Not
as you will in the cinema. Yeah, what were your thoughts on Ennis Maine?
I really wanted to like it. So I liked Bate, and like you say, I mean, he's got this kind of incredibly uncompromising, unique vision, but I did struggle with it. I mean, I really struggled to kind of piece it together as a story, which I'm, you know, I mean, I'm sure is intentional, that it's not meant to be followed in a very sort of linear way, and it's not going to give up all its secrets. I mean, that's not the type of experience he's going for, but I did find it quite frustrating and quite repetitive as well. Although, I mean, that is obviously, he's tapping into the rhythms of, you know, living alone, living on this island, having this very sort of frugal existence, like pumping up the generator every time she wants to boil a kettle and keeping monitoring these flowers. But it just left me scratching my head, I'm afraid, by the end of it, as much as I admired all the kind of the technical skill and the performances and the just unique vibes of it all. Didn't leave me with too much else, I'm afraid.
Would you like to see him go on to do, for want of a better word, traditional project, to see what he could put onto that?
I'd maybe like to see him do a sort of middle ground thing where he kind of takes on perhaps something scripted by someone else, a kind of a more straightforward story, but brings all his kind of technical nous to it. You know, the way he does this kind of, he abandons all the on location sound and then recreates it in the lab afterwards. He does it all very much. It's all sort of a one man show. I'd really like to see him do that, and that the kind of weathered visuals that he seems to specialize in. I'd quite like to see that, but kind of apply to a bit more of a perhaps more engaging story. I think that could be quite interesting.
I suppose in the case of Ennis Main, we have, as I mentioned, seen a couple of other folk horrors recently.
Yeah.
Whereas something like Bait was so out of, you know, hadn't seen anything like that before. Not just because of the way he physically made the film, but even the storyline, which was sort of dealing with, I suppose, gentrification of this sort of Cornish sort of seaside town where the character was living. And, you know, it was just an unusual story in itself. That pricked people's ears, I think. I mean, it was a little different to Fisherman's Friends, if you remember that.
Utterly different. Yeah. Perhaps his next project will be kind of some sort of mixture of those two films. Perhaps he will develop a kind of themes in his films in that way, kind of follow on. Ennis Main did remind me very much. I mean, you mentioned The Wicker Man, but things like Don't Look Now, there's like a very prominently coloured raincoat that pops up quite a lot. So that kind of put me in the mind of that.
Yeah, I think I interviewed Jenkin back in Cannes, and I mentioned Don't Look Now and the red coat. And I'm having to do this from memory now, but I'm pretty sure that was a total accident.
Okay,
and then it wasn't a deliberate reference.
No.
And then someone pointed out to him, yeah, you do realize that's a stark reminder of Don't Look Now. And I think he was kind of like, oh, God. But by that point, it was too difficult to change.
Yeah.
If I'm remembering that correctly. So forgive me, Mark, if I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, he does seem like someone who's kind of marching to the beat of his own drum and not sort of looking to ways to pay homage or kind of wear his influences on his sleeves. I mean, I enjoyed that aspect of it, that it is a standout film in that sense. There's nothing else quite like it around.
If you are interested in his influences, I think at the British Film Institute in London at the moment, where obviously the film, as I said, is playing, he's also programmed a bunch of other films that are influential on him. So you can go and see his new movie and then go and peek into his mind. And I think he included Jean Dielman, the film that just finished top of the Sight and Sound poll. That was one of his choices. But there's lots of different movies in his selection, so that might be of interest to people.
Okay, so that's Ennis Main. That's in cinemas from Friday. And there's also the curated season that's on the BFI South Bank and on BFI Player throughout January. All right, so let's move on. So our last film of the week, and it's been a while since we've seen Nicolas Cage, but good news, here's Nicolas Cage.
Tell me the names of the men who did this.
As long as that little girl is alive, there's no room for vengeance.
You're protecting a killer.
From another killer.
Can you teach me how to shoot?
Okay, so that's The Old Way. So, James, is there anything new going on in The Old Way?
I like that. That's a very good link. well, yeah, I suppose in the sense that here Nicolas Cage is not doing batshit crazy Nicolas Cage.
No.
Despite the fact he's he plays a gunslinger from the sort of 19th century, who at the very beginning of the film is obviously, he's got a terrible moustache, which obviously means he's completely evil. Did you like the moustache? Okay. When I say terrible, I mean it was, that's your signpost for the fact that he's, you know, a bad un, a wrong un.
Yeah.
He's clearly spent his entire life killing people. And at the very beginning, we see him kill someone. Obviously, the victim's young son is there watching his dad go down. So you kind of know that that boy will be growing up and coming back for Nicolas Cage's character. His name is Colton Briggs. I thought he was quite a good character name, actually.
It's a good
Colton
Cage Briggs. Name. Yeah.
But yeah, when we move on into the film proper, 20 years down the line, he's married, he runs a general store, he's got a young daughter. You know, he's a good guy now. He doesn't go around killing people. But needless to say, that vengeful cowboy comes back looking for him and it all goes downhill from there. You've seen that kind of Western a million times before, but I quite like seeing Cage do a Western. I mean, it's been a while. I can't really think of a Western that he's been in for a while.
Well, apparently this is his first ever Western. I mean, yeah.
That's probably why I can't think of one. Yeah. That's amazing.
Given the volume of his filmography, the number of genres he's done. But yeah, to think he hasn't done a Western until now.
If you are a Cage fan, it's been a good few years in of there was Pig, The Unbelievable Weight of Massive Talent. There's been a few interesting Cage films where he's traded on his persona very well. This just feels a bit run-of-the-mill, a bit, you know, ho-hum. I enjoyed it for a while, but by the end it was, you know, there wasn't anything very distinct about it. I don't know if you felt the same.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. It just felt like an old kind of B-movie, really, that you might have seen back in the day, you know, that might have run for like an hour before the main feature back in the 40s or 50s. But yeah, I felt like there was nothing really new going on in this, except for there's like a discussion halfway through between him and his daughter where they're kind of talking about how they're struggling to feel, like this girl's talking about how she doesn't really feel anything about the death of her mother, and he kind of relates to that. So it's sort of hinting at like a theme of perhaps of autism. It's kind of approaching that, but then it doesn't really do anything with it, and it kind of gets back on its very sort of linear revenge plot and plays out in a very predictable way. I thought the action was very run of the mill as well. Although in some places,
that's the disappointing bit, isn't it? You sort of would hope, if you're going to have a run-of-the-mill revenge plot, let's at least make the gunfights smoking, basically. But it wasn't exactly the Wild Bunch, was it? Or, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
No, not at all. No, I was really looking forward to a big showdown. I thought this will be the time when it kind of redeems itself. It'll pull something out of the bag. But, I mean, that's kind of over in the blink of an eye. And then it just kind of wraps up. So, yeah, very, very disappointing, very forgettable. Well, shame, really. I mean, he does have another Western coming up. He's got this film called Butcher's Crossing, which was at Toronto, which apparently has got better reviews. So hopefully that'll appeal more. But
he's such a strange actor, Cage. It's like,
he really is.
I remember being at the Berlin Film Festival. I think it was when 8mm was around, the Joel Schumacher film. It was quite a while ago. That was the point that he was in that sort of Con Air, The Rock face-off period where he was being paid like $20 million a movie, and he was at that Tom Cruise kind of level.
And then
he did really interesting things. I mean, Adaptation, the Spike Jones Charlie Kaufman film, is one of my all-time favorite movies. I think it's just an absolute work of genius, and he was brilliant in that. You know, every 5 years or so sporadically finds these kind of incredible movies. I wasn't a huge fan of The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, but I appreciated what it was trying to do. And he will take risks like that. But now, in between, it's a bit like John Cusack. You know, again, John Cusack has done some brilliant films across his time, but there's a lot of fluff in between these days. And, you know, man's got to make a living. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm sure if people analyze my articles, they'll go, yeah, there's a lot of fluff in there alongside the occasional decent piece. But
are you saying you're the Nick Cage of film journalism?
I may well be. Yeah, I may well be. Maybe not quite as crazy, but it's odd. I'm surprised that Cage doesn't get to do more big scale movies that, you know, in the way that, say, Dwayne Johnson does. I mean, okay, Cage is a little bit older than him, but you sort of think he's got that movie star persona still. I'm surprised he's not more in demand for the upper echelon kind of blockbusters.
Yeah. Well, he does have Renfield coming out, which he plays. He's playing Dracula opposite Nicholas Holt as Renfield, which looks quite a lot of fun. I don't know if you've seen the trailer yet, but it looks like that could be.
I'm a little bit aware of that film. I'm trying to think the last, maybe not the last Ren film, but the one that sticks out in my mind is it Tom Waits in the Coppola?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
Dracula movie. Yeah. That was always quite an interesting performance, an interesting character to sort of build a film around. So yeah, he always does find interesting films, but then there's a lot of throwaway stuff as well, and the old way very much falls into that category, unfortunately.
Really is. Yeah, I mean, just the title itself isn't really that interesting. It doesn't.
I actually keep getting it confused with The Old Guard, which is Charlize Theron Netflix, which I never even saw. But I just keep getting that confused. So yeah, that is a very generic title, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's no Ennis Main, is it, or Megan with a three in the middle,
or even Tar? We have even Tar with the little accent on the A and done in capital letters in quite a pretentious way. But I quite like that about Tar, that it has one of those slightly annoying titles to write. It means you've always got to, you know, think about that. But get yourself an annoying title. That'll annoy film journalists. So
it really does. Yeah, I hate to moan, but come on, filmmakers. We don't want generic like the old way. It's forgettable. We don't want these other ones with tricky characters that we can't remember. So
Megan with a three in the title instead of an E. I mean, that's also, you know, you can make them. You can that can trip you up as well.
It really, yeah, I can see lots of people missing that when they write it. So we're not really recommending The Old Way.
No, I don't think so.
No.
That's like an empty gun barrel, basically.
that's a very good way to sum it up. So if you do fancy seeing The Old Way by any chance, it's in cinemas from Friday and also available on digital. So I'm guessing The Old Way is not your film of the week, but what is your film of the week?
It has to be Tar. But I would say, just as a little, you know, aside, for fun, I had a lot of fun with Megan.
Yeah, I think Tar is the best film out this week, but Megan is the one that's closest to my heart, and I'll be watching again. I very much enjoyed that. Okay, so that's nearly all we've got time for this week. But a reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press the button now and you're all set. Just before we go, we've got time for a listener's question. And this week, it's what is the greatest scene set on a plane in movies?
It's a great question and difficult one to answer. Yeah. I don't know if this is the greatest scene, but it's definitely one. It's one I saw recently again.
Okay.
And I think it's a brilliant piece of filmmaking. It's on in the Bond movie, The Living Daylights, where I think they're flying over. I think it's Afghanistan, if I remember. Yeah. But they're Bond and the baddie are kind of in the back of the plane. And then there's this sort of net full of bags of, I think it's supposed to be heroin, but forgive me if I've got that incorrect. But in one of these bags is a bomb, of course. There's always a bomb in a Bond film. And then this net thing is kind of caught up in on the back of the plane. The back of the plane opens. This net thing falls out. And they're scrambling around in the open air on this net thing. And all I can say about the end, if you've not seen it, it's bootylicious, basically. That will make sense. But it's a brilliant piece of filmmaking. So that's one of my favourites.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? Yeah, I think that's one of the best stunts in a Bond film. I'd never forget seeing that for the first time. Seeing these them hanging off this great net at the end. It's fantastic. I don't think Uncharted did it quite as well when it tried to.
I've refused to watch Uncharted because I haven't seen it. I didn't have to review it. I love the video games. They're just absolutely brilliant, and I just can't bring myself. Everyone tells me The Last of Us is really good. What I've been seeing for the reviews, which is another amazing video game, but I might give that a go just based on the good word of mouth. But I heard Uncharted was fine.
It's decent, solid. Yeah. I'm holding on for Super Mario Brothers. That's
well, that at least kind of looks a bit like the video game. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Chris Pratt as Mario, that's okay. That's quite fun.
Yeah.
What is your plane?
Well, I've got two. They both involve alcohol, strangely enough. There's Bridesmaids with Kristen Wiig getting trolleyed. Mm-hmm. It always makes me laugh. And then Flight with Denzel Washington, where he's had a quick nip of something to keep him going, and then he ends up flying the plane upside down. And I just thought that was utterly terrifying, that inversion. Yeah, just so alarming, that whole scene. I mean, it kind of spoils the rest of the movie because nothing else can quite live up to the impact of that scene at the start. But yeah, that really sticks in my mind. And
and obviously a word for snakes on a plane as well. And actually, for the best snakes on a plane.
Yes, yeah, you can't really top that. Okay, so that's all we have time for this week. So say goodbye, James.
Bye.
Goodbye, and we'll see you soon. Bye bye.